And we are back. Luke Taylor here, Cork and Taylor Wine Podcast. Thanks for listening. Before we start, I just want to remind you, if you like or even love this podcast, I know it's hard to believe. It's very difficult to believe. The three people that listen are not my wife, not my mother-in-law, not my mother. So this is going to be a bitch fest on them. So anyway, just remember to be sure to rate it, be sure to review it, be sure to tell all your wine friends about and tell them to subscribe to the Cork and Taylor Wine Podcast. As by subscribing, when a new episode comes out, they will get a notification. Also follow us and comment on our Cork and Taylor Facebook and Instagram pages. If you actually like this podcast and you want to support us, for as little as $7 a month, you get some exclusive behind-the-scenes content and great bonus material. Join us on our Cork and Taylor Patreon page, www.patreon.com/Cork and Taylor. So I have to be nice to our next guest because I'm a Michigan fan. My wife's a Michigan graduate. He's a Michigan State graduate, as I think is your wife. After the little debacle, the actual beatdown at the big house, I'm scared he might throw a helmet at me. We've got a fellow hockey lover. Even though I'm a Maple Leaf fan, he's a Red Wing fan. We both love wine. We both love Detroit. I got a gentleman by the name of Douglas Danilak. Welcome.
Well,
to the Cork and Taylor Wine Podcast. That's all? I gave you that great introduction, and I say thanks for having me.
I wanted to know if you wanted to start with hockey first, or we're going to start with wine first, or we'll just we'll mix it up. Nice.
It's going to intertwine. So, you know, let's first question I want to ask you. And really the only question I really care about, because I'm probably going to be the only one listening. What are your thoughts on Windsor?
I have a Windsor Spitfire jersey that I wear every week at hockey. I love it. For my family, bingo capital of the world. And when we were 17 years old, going over the Ambassador Bridge, that's where we got our flats in Molson, and came back over the Ambassador Bridge. And so many fond memories of Windsor.
Yes. Would you say Windsor, Ontario, Canada shaped your wine career?
Well, certainly hockey had a part in the wine career when I was younger. And after figuring out very quickly that I had no hockey career, I had to find something else to do. And that's actually what led me to wine. It's a true story.
Yeah. So you are the first person I know that graduated from Michigan State with a French international relations degree. That kind of limits what you can kind of do, right?
The program is kind of meant for a feeder into international law. So my choices were, you know, I was going to apply for law school, and I had gotten, you know, bitten by the wine bug when I was actually in my teens on a trip to France. So I kept doing it all through college, and then I decided, you know, I can go into law school, sit behind a desk 90 hours a week. Passionate about it, but I was much more passionate about wine because we had offered this chance to travel, it offered this chance to explore history, offered a chance to explore French history, and then the added benefit of, you know, the mystery of fermentation science and fermentation in all the various regions of France. So being a Francophile, I spent a lot of time in every region, but really put down my roots in Burgundy. So,
hence why the Pont-Neuf winery, which you have with your wife, does Chardonnay and Pinot Noir.
Does Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. And in fact, the wine you're about to taste, we make single vineyard Chardonnays and Pinots, very much in keeping with the Burgundian ideal of a single parcel that you get We use all French clonal material for our wines, and very small and distinct plots, as you would find in Burgundy, same size as like a Premier Grand Cru. But the key is that we decided if we were ever going to make wine, we would absolutely do it in the same way and spirit as the great vintners we'd studied with in Burgundy. So when I was going to school in Burgundy, I had the very good fortune to work with Dominique Lafon, got me into the Beaune winemaking school. And then within my class, there are a lot of household names that were my classmates, including Frédéric Meunier, Anne Gros, Françoise Nielon, just to name a few. And so we have this great relationship in Burgundy stretching back to the 80s.
Yeah. So you returned to California. How long were you over in France for? Or Burgundy?
3.5 years. So quite a while. We bought a home there, okay. And we were planning to stay. But unfortunately, due to visa and work restrictions and a few other hurdles, we weren't able to stay in France and work. So we'd had a connection here in the States who offered us plenty of opportunity, who was a barrel broker and one of the true geniuses of the wine business. And if you want to have a good interview, I would recommend you speak to him. His name is Mel Knox, and he's a barrel broker. He sells the world's best barrels and is probably one of the most insightful people in the wine business, and the funniest.
Mr. Wood.
Mr. Wood, do you know Mel?
No. Does he know the Cork and Taylor Wine Podcast, more importantly?
More importantly, no, but I'll be happy to introduce you, and I will. I think you'd be delighted to talk with the person we all affectionately refer to as Uncle Mel. And he's a...
Uncle Mel.
Uncle Mel. He's a genius on a lot of matters, but particularly when it comes to wine, and obviously knows the world of wine barrels very, very well.
So in the late 80s, you were part of a tasting group of Pinot and Chardonnay with some well-regarded people. One was a former guest of the Cork and Taylor Wine Podcast, David Ramey.
Right. So when we came back from Burgundy, this is hard to imagine, but in 1989, 1990, Chardonnay and Pinot Noir in California was just getting established. And we could, between both counties, only get really 12 vintners interested to do regular tastings. So our group... was John Wetlaufer and Helen Turley, and John was running the All Seasons wine shop at the time. So every Monday night we would taste Grand Cru and Premier Cru Burgundy against the best of California. And so in the group was Helen Turley, David Ramey, Ted Lemon, Mark Aubert, myself, Kistler, you name it. These were the 12 people we could get together to taste Chardonnay and Pinot on a regular basis. So, and now, obviously that invitation would have grown, but, it was
to at least 13.
Yeah, at least 13. So I guess the big advantage I had was when I was working in Burgundy and going to school, my job was to take all the California vintners around and translate for them. Because this is a time when everybody wanted to learn how to make Chardonnay. So my job was to translate for all these California vintners. And then when I came back to California, of course, it was only natural that I was in the group tasting and, securing the wines and then bringing my Burgundy experience to the table. But it was a great group, very, very open, I would say, among winemakers. It's generally a group that was just passionate about driving quality above everything else. And as you know, with Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, there's really no room for error. There's no room for not holding true to a lot of those great pieces of wisdom that you get from.
Why is that?
Well, you've got two grapes that are very, very sensitive to weather extremes, number one, and they're very, very sensitive to poor weather, right? So in the case of Chardonnay, depending on the clone and how you grow it, it can rot quite easily. And so you have to be very vigilant there. And then, of course, with Pinot Noir, it is exceedingly sensitive to yield. It has this tipping point where, you know, it's roughly around 2 tons to the acre, where if you go above it, you really, you know, risk losing all the quality, all the kind of aromatic drive, and the wine becomes rather simple and straightforward rather than the complex, you know, beautiful grape that Pinot can be. So certainly they're things you do out of passion. You know, not only that, the wine you're tasting, for example, the Pont Marie, one of the things we do is with the Chardonnay is we squeeze it very, very gently in the press. So most wineries are looking for 160 gallons out of each ton of fruit. We are only at about 130 gallons per ton. And why that is if you extract that last 10 to 20%, that's where all the bitterness comes from in white wine and in Chardonnay. So we do quite a bit of, we do hyperoxidation and really good settling of the juice. So you end up with a wine that is not only delicate, it's round, but it's ageable as well. And I think what's really interesting and what we're trying to do at Pont Neuf is set this new standard for California wine is that we've proven that we can do power in on the West Coast. The question is, can we build that power with finesse and ageability over time? So what's nice is you can go back and taste the 10-year-old Chardonnay of ours and it's still as fresh as a daisy, right? And that's because we're doing the hyperoxidation of the wine using the world's very best barrels from Burgundy, low yields and really gentle pressing, and all those things combined to make a wine which has great intensity, great aromas, but also the ability to age. And why I believe that's important is that when you live in Burgundy, I think a lot of people are unaware that in Burgundy, you don't open a Chardonnay before 10 years of age, a great Chardonnay. You leave it in the cellar for a minimum of 10 years. If you've got a Merceau Perrier, you've got a Bataille Montrachet, you don't think about opening that before 10 years. And I think, of course, the public mindset for the bulk of the Chardonnay in the world as well, it has to be consumed within 2 years. And it's kind of short selling what the grape can do, gaining secondary and tertiary aromas in the bottle as it ages.
We call that in America, cougar crack.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So did you taste the Pont Marie? Yeah.
Do you? Oh, delicious.
Very nice.
Yeah, very, very nice. And what I feel like, and you would know this better than me because you obviously make wine, I just drink it and sell it. But Chardonnay, traditional style Chardonnay, if you look at, let's say, Rombauer Chardonnay, and I'm not throwing it under the bus, that is not what Chardonnay really is. I mean, is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think it's a comment on that you can make Chardonnay in many different styles. There's many different price points from all around the world, but to achieve greatness, it's a variety that takes a great, great deal of care. And so, you know, to arrive at above a certain bar, you have to start practicing all those things that we just spoke about, which is low yields in the vineyard, really gentle pressing, using great oak, treating the wine super carefully in the cellar, and then bringing it to bottle to age. So, and I think to your point, you know, once you do get into some of the lower or less expensive versions of Chardonnay, in fact, you know, Dave Ramey and I were talking about this, you might be better off drinking another white varietal at the lower price point rather than drinking Chardonnay at the lower price point, because there's generally better value in things like a Sauvignon Blanc or other varietals at the lower price point, and save your special wine for your wine dollars for Chardonnay on the high end.
Yeah. So you're telling me this Chardonnay has some time in the bottle.
Yeah, it has quite a while in the bottle, and I'm, you know, looking forward to seeing these at 20 years. And again, I think it, everyone's impression of Chardonnay is it has to be consumed early. But if you take great vintners around the world, they treat the grape with such care that the wines will age enormously and become absolutely mind-expanding wines, drinking Burgundies from the 40s, white Burgundies from the 40s, 50s, 60s. They're just fascinating wines, and they're great wines, and some of the most memorable wines you'll ever have. So, you know, it's just kind of a part of the wine world that's been forgotten, but it is great to drink that wine you're having now, the 2019. If you have that in 2030, you're just going to, I think, have a great experience with it as well.
Mm-hmm. So can I put the cork back in it and let it lay down for 20 years?
Well, if it were full, you could, but I'm hoping that you're going to enjoy the rest of it with your wife and your family tonight.
Yeah, I'm going to pour it for my kids that are 13, 9, and 7.
Oh, no. You're a busy man.
What's oh, no? There's nothing wrong with that. There's a 9-year-old drinking wine right now somewhere in the world.
That's true. That's true. But yeah, I think you'll see it change too. I think what's nice about Chardonnay that has some interest to it is that each glass is going to be a different experience, right? You're going to have that first glass, and as air hits it, you're going to see an hour later that it has a different set of aromas and flavors. And it's not uncommon in Burgundy as well, when you've got a Coucherie or a Lafond or a Great Meursault. A young one like that is, people do decant them quite a bit. A lot of Somms will decant like a 2019 white just because they know there's that much more to come.
Yeah. All right, let's go to the Pont Neuf, Lavage, Russian River Valley, Pinot Noir.
Yes, and which vintage do you have in front of?
Made in the USA.
Oh, that's a great story, because we had the world's best label designer, Chuck House, do our label, and he has a book you might have seen called Icon, The Art of the Wine Label. So he's done every famous label that you might have heard of. He's done everything from Spotswood to Bonnie Doon to Ornellaia to ours to, you know, it's a who's who of wine labels. And he did it rather, knowing our story, and you see all the wines from France, they say Produit de France. He says, I'm going to, you know, put Made in the USA, not because we insisted on it. He said it just gives the label balance. It perfectly balances out the eye when you look at the label. We said, great. And, you know, we're obviously proud that it's made in the US. So, and Lavage is to me, it's very much a Pinot lover's Pinot Noir, right? Because it captures every sort of aspect of Pinot. It's got the kind of undescribable berry fruits with a sort of forest mushroom floor, but also made in not a sweet style. It's made in a savory way, so that you can imagine this wine at table, whether you're having, you know, roast chicken, duck legs with turnips, you know, of course, Boeuf Bourguignon's great. We usually make a Boeuf Bourguignon using some of that wine, and then having the same wine with dinner. And that's always a real treat.
Yeah. You know who loves talking about food and wine pairings is David Ramey.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, David and I, we get together at least once a year, if not more often, and we go out to lunch and we talk quite a bit. And David was an early mentor for me in Burgundy, because he was that perfect balance of me understanding the tradition of the old world in Burgundy, where I was making wine, and the sort of California scientific approach, which was very persistent on doing every kind of trial and exploring, you know, the science of wine. So I very much appreciated David for his openness and his ability to share his experience without being, understanding that you are here for a short time and you're just a shepherd for all these great vineyards, and that if you can pass along knowledge to a younger generation, that is kind of your job as a winemaker, right? Is to keep that idea going.
Would you say David Ramey is a better person or a better winemaker?
Oh, well, that I'd say he's both, because he's we've always challenged each other in kind of intellectual ways, not in any combative way, you know, where he would bring a wine to me and say, how close is this getting to a Burgundian aroma profile? And I would say yes or no and give him reasons why. And so we'd have those kinds of exchanges, especially early on, where we were trying to, you know, understand how to get to the sort of refinement and the greatness of Burgundy, which, you know, when people are always asking about it, is, you know, it's this combination of power and elegance that you cannot replace. It's only found in great vineyards, you know, throughout the world, whether that's Tokalon or Bertard Montrocher or, you know, certain Barolo vineyards. But I think now with what you're tasting, hopefully from the Pont-Neuf wines, is that we're getting to this point with Chardonnay and Pinot Noir where the wines are, you know, there's no reason to be ashamed about elegance and beauty, and wines that have just a ton of flavor and ageability at the same time. You know, when I first returned to California, it was all about power. And I think it spoke to what's great about America, is that we learn something, we take it in, and we say, okay, what happens if I turn the dial up to 10 and put the accelerator all the way to the floor, right? And I think what we learned there with Chardonnay is we ended up with some pretty odd experiments with Chardonnay and styles, you know, and now people have started to understand that these grapes kind of deserve, they don't always work in that kind of powerful setting, you know, or framework.
How often do you rely on other winemakers to bounce ideas off, to get feedback from?
Well, I think, you know, like the group that we had in Calistoga, I think we all did that, you know, very, very warmly and genuinely. I have the good fortune of being married to my wife, also from Detroit, also a hockey widow. But she was wine buyer at Oakville Grocery for almost 20 years. So she got to see the whole evolution of the wine industry in Napa Valley and Sonoma Valley. And so she has a great palate. And so for example, the Pont Marie is actually her wine, in that I bring her to the cellar and I give her the thief. And I say, pick out your barrels of Chardonnay that speak to you for Pont Marie from this single parcel that is the Pont Marie. And she picks out her wine, and I know she'll choose the most poised and elegant expression of Chardonnay. So I have the very good fortune every night when I come home is to have this great palate to share all the wines that I make with her. And she's just an integral part of it. So I'm very, very lucky.
So when she leaves the house or the room, tell us how you really feel about her.
She actually can't hear this right now. But, you know, I think the one thing that where winemakers often can get a little bit lost is you can certainly develop a house palate. And, you know, after you have made a vintage and you've tasted this wine, I don't know, between 50 and 100 times, maybe more, you can easily lose perspective, right, on kind of where that balance is or where that charming point is or where that sweet spot is. So having Mary as the sounding board, I will often bring her the last three versions of a wine, and she will point to it, and that's the one I bottle, because I know that she has the same sensibility of having lived and worked in Burgundy, and that, you know, with great Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, you know, you'll hear a lot of people talk about, gee, there's this wine and I love it, but I can't quite put my finger on it. And I tell them that's when you know you're in the presence of the great wine, right? When it's got all these flavor and energy and movement and persistence, and you love it, but it has so much movement and so many different layers of flavor that you can't just say it's one, two, or three things. It's not just, you know, coconut, cherry, and something, right? And that's when you know you've kind of succeeded with Pinot Noir and Chardonnay.
Yeah. Is that why a lot of winemakers drink hard liquor?
Well, you know, it's funny.
Just saying.
You know, it's a long way from Boilermakers in Detroit to Burgundy, that's for sure. But yeah, there's a few who get into the spirits. I'm not like a regular spirits drinker, but I do love great fine Calvados and Armagnacs and some things with some age on it.
Yeah. Well, why the name Pont-Neuf?
Well, Pont-Neuf is really very easy. Pont-Neuf is the most important bridge that spans the Seine River in Paris. And Pont-Neuf means new bridge. And really what our wines are a new bridge to the old world, right? So we're bringing a lot of that sensibility that we gained in Burgundy and bringing it back to the new world and kind of giving people a different take on Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. And while I can't speak to, you know, every other wine out there, a lot of people just comment that the wines that we make are very, very close in terms of the pleasure factor of what they get out of Burgundy.
Mm-hmm. Nice. I like it. I get it. I see the bridge on the label now.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And that's Chuck House's brilliance. And he's another person that you might want to talk to. I think among people who are not actually winemakers, the two people you'd want to interview are Chuck House, and who's the label designer, and Mel Knox, who's the barrel broker. Both genius in their own respect.
Well, now you know the truth is why I'm interviewing you. I don't really care about you. I want to be about all your contacts.
Exactly, as it should be.
Now, I will tell you, because we're going to talk about the next set of wines, you have a hockey name.
Right. So here's how the name came about. So we were going to start making our Pont-Neuf wines, and we needed to file a name for our corporation in California. And we were watching the hockey game, the Red Wings game, no less. And Mary says, well, don't worry about it. Let's just call it Juicy Rebound LLC. So we called it Juicy Rebound LLC. And then all the next day, the guys at hockey were like, well, what'd you call your label? I said, well, for right now, it's Juicy Rebound. They're like, well, I'll take a case of that. So we started quite organically with this whole idea of Juicy Rebound, and the Juicy Rebound became all these wines that I come across in my consulting life that are too good to not offer to the public, right? They're just small parcels of wine, and I'll just give you one example. So if I do consulting work for Winery X that makes a wine that's $400 and they have three barrels of wine left over because they only wanted a certain percentage of cab in the blend, those three barrels are obviously first run great wine, $400 wine. They just don't want it is that percentage of the blend. So I take those and then I can bring those to the market under the Juicy Rebound label at a much more favorable price so people can taste some of the very best vineyards.
So your name is Cameron Hughes.
No, I don't. I think it's a totally different model from that. Totally different model from that. Where
I don't know.
These are definitely smaller parcels or grapes that we get from growers that are in great appellations. For example, you probably have Oakville in front of you and you have a Napa Valley.
Yep.
Those are from the Napa Valley, so a mix of Rutherford and Napa. I'm sorry, Rutherford in Oakville, and then the Oakville is just pure Oakville right off the Oakville bench.
Look at that color.
And it's, again, amazing wines that are, you know, it gives people a chance to experience wines that are among the best of Napa at a very, very under $100 a bottle, which is hard to find these days.
Yeah, especially with the label Napa on it.
Exactly. And so, you know, the cost of production in everywhere, just along with inflation, has pushed everybody's cost of production up considerably. And in Napa, that's no exception, where it's kind of, you know, you'll find some under $100 Napa cabs, but in terms of getting into the sub-appellations and things like that, most everything's over $100 now. So,
yeah. So it sounds like you're working less, making more money.
Oh, yeah. We're just raking it in over here. you know, one of the things that, you know, with... I think with all vintners that people fail to understand is people who are kind of into what they do, you know, that group, is that we don't start our year with our business plan nailed to the wall. We start off with our wine plan. And then, you know, if money comes out of that, that's just a blessing. You know, we do everything that's right for the wine. You know, sometimes we'll drop fruit in the vineyard three times. But you have to make those financial sacrifices to arrive at a wine that just, you know, is supposed to knock your socks off. And, you know, I think certainly more lucrative would have been the league going into the legal world, but nothing would have been more rewarding than following the path of making wine and kind of following that passion.
Do you think a lot of people have your philosophy, especially in Napa, about dropping fruit and stuff like that? Because, I mean, it's so competitive, and it's it's just tougher and tougher to sell wine.
Yeah, it is. It's tougher and tougher. You know, the dynamics have changed and shifted quite a bit, where now there's been so much paid for the property by investors who really don't have to think about, you know, these things are not
proper. Just say it. Say Schaefer.
Well, I mean, you know, whether it's Schaefer Heights, you know, whatever, you know, these iconic family brands that were built and built the Napa name, you know, when someone comes offers you that kind of money, kind of, I'm sure, hard to resist for many people who've put their lives into it, or maybe the second generation doesn't want to follow through. And I think it's a dynamic that we're seeing around the world where, and I would encourage, you know, you, because you reach, you know, like you say, three, four people, but hopefully hundreds and hundreds of, you know, the world of wine and small winemaking.
No, three, four.
Three, four. Okay. All right. Plus the kids, right? but you know, the small vintner around the world needs to be championed if you still want to see individual winemaking, because everything else is getting consolidated among the big players. And when I do some consulting in France, and every place I've gone to that used to be small cooperatives and things have now been bought up by a lot of the big names that you know in the business, you know, and they're just disappearing, right? So the small vintner, the small grower,
is that a trend you can see continuing going?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, whether it's here or in France, you know, I mean, we spend a lot of time in the Beaujolais or with Beaujolais growers, and they couldn't for the longest time put together a living, you know, just making Beaujolais and selling Beaujolais. So they often had to have second and third jobs. And many of them sold the family domain just to go pursue other things that made real money. But, you know, the challenge of the wine business is that, you know, one year you'll have a normal income, and then you'll have a 2022 where there's a fire and you get, you know, great, you know, we made 20 grand this year, and that's your year. And that's what you have to accept, you know, as part of being a vintner. And I think the difficulty is the perception is if wine is expensive, then you're kind of making all this money. And I'll just recount a quick story. I went into a retail account, and the guy was very generous about the wines, and he ordered three cases. And I said, "Wow, that's great. Thank you very much. I can now get two new front tires on my car." And he says, "Well, wait, you're a rich winery guy, right?" And I was like, "No, I'm getting two new front tires on my car." You know, so it's not as lucrative as you might think, but you know, it's
what you didn't tell him is you've got a Maserati.
Yeah, right. No, I tell you what, I got an 8-year-old beater Volvo is what I got, and because it carries around stinky hockey equipment
is stinky.
Oh, it's the worst. And my wife is super.
Yep. Yeah, but you remember I remember growing up, and my mom and dad, my mom, she is your traditional British woman. Everything's clean and smells good. That hockey equipment would stay in the trunk of the car all winter, and it smelled like ass.
Well,
I can smell it right now.
Are you still playing?
No, you know, I'm in Akron, Ohio, and my if I lived in Canada, I would.
Right. But have you, when's the last?
It's just tough. So my father-in-law puts together a rink, so I bought some skates, and I was like, so I go to the hockey shop about 35 minutes from our house. And like hockey skates, the cheap kind are like $300.
Absolutely.
A stick's like $200.
Absolutely. It's outrageous. And I've been living off, I've made wine for some NHL players. And so I've been living off all of their training camp castaways, sticks, pants, you name it. And that's the only way I can keep myself in hockey.
Jock straps.
Yeah, so I've got a new stick on the way.
Never, never use another man's jock strap.
No, that's the one part I wouldn't exchange. But you know, I had the good fortune to make some wine for some NHL players and be around them and just had really great experiences all the way around with them. So
you know, I grew up in Oakville, Ontario, Canada. So I'm drinking the 2017 Juicy Rebound Cabernet Appellation Oakville. I've got a thing for Oakville, and I know it's not where I'm from. I grew up skating at 18 months old, loved hockey, played hockey. I have never heard in my recollection of 46 years on this great earth, never heard the reference Juicy Rebound.
Really?
Don Cherry, Ron McLean.
There you go. Hockey night in Canada.
Ron McLean was a neighbor.
Really? He seems like a super nice guy, and he actually
lived behind us.
He goes around to different Canadian cities, and some of my friends in Canada, we sell a lot of wine up there, sold him some wine, and he came back for some of our wine, and we exchanged, I think, an email maybe 8-10 years ago, but he seems like the nicest guy. Most genuine guy.
Yeah, he's got three little dogs.
Three little dogs. Wow. So was he a neighbor for a long time?
What's that tell you about him?
There you go. Was he there for a long time? Your neighbor for a long time?
Probably. He lived just behind us, the street over. Probably like 10, 12 years.
Wow. Cool. Yeah.
Yeah, he was a nice guy.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's so funny. I love... you know, the attachment of Canadians and hockey, and I've got friends to whom I sell wine in just about every province. And my buddy in Calgary, they'll lose two games, and he'll say, you know, hockey's dead to me. You know, I stopped watching. And you could,
we're different,
totally different about the game. And but the passion, the understanding of the game, you know, is just.
Well, people in Quebec even more so are crazy. They win the Stanley Cup, they burn the town down. They lose the Stanley Cup, they burn this town down.
No, I think burning the town down is the right of Detroit. I think that's they stole our game, burning the town down. But yeah,
Wow.
so do you get back to Canada often now?
Yeah, I mean, when they allow me in, it's usually get a deep cavity search, but you know, it's fine.
Tell me.
I have dual citizenship, so we go back a little bit.
Tell me about your journey into wine. How did you end up with this great passion of wine and the podcast?
You know, so my background is, I've never been asked this before. This is kind of cool. So about 12 years ago, I started a wine distributorship in Ohio. My best friend, my brother, my niece are all in the restaurant industry. They're chefs, and I've always been around wine. And went to university in Chicago, and you know, you got Binnie's and Sam's, so you just kind of learn about it. And got out of a previous career, and probably was having a midlife crisis at 34, first child, and said to my wife, "I'm going to start a wine distributorship."
Awesome.
And probably know quite a few people that you know through selling wine and then obviously through the podcast. But my background was in television, TV. I was in TV for about 3 years.
Oh, okay. And that makes.
Dubuque, Iowa, and Cedar Rapids. You might familiar see me there, very familiar with that.
Yeah.
Chicago, and then back in Canada.
Oh, that's great. That's a nice kind of transition for sure. That's really neat. And
And I started the podcast because, you know, a lot of the people I know are just fun people. They're not, it's not stuffy, and it's just something different, and learning about different places and people and traveling. And so, you know, once we get up to 10 listeners, we'll maybe get to France
Italy
and
and
Italy
Spain.
and Spain.
Well, you know,
We're getting closer by the second.
getting closer by the second. Well, you know, as long as it's much like, you know, the making of the wine, if you're passionate about it, which you clearly are, you have the background in the audio visual presentation world, communications world, as long as you stick with it, you'll be successful. And I'm sure, you know, you seem like a very happy guy and you know, as you should be, as long as you're following your passion.
A lot of alcohol.
That, well, you know, that helps. It's already past noon there, so you're in the zone. You know, you're fine.
Oh, I know. I got to coach kids basketball tonight.
Oh, there you go. That should be what age? The 9-year-olds or?
Yeah. I've got the 13-year-old, and then I got to coach the 9-year-old. 27 third grade boys in a gym.
Oof. Well, not really smelly yet, but what's the score like, 22 to 18, or is it higher than
First year playing, I don't know. We'll see. It's kind of like, let's catch the ball and chuck it.
So,
So let me ask you something before I forget this.
sure.
How different is it working with, say, a Chardonnay, Pinot Noir grape or wine to a Cabernet? Is there much difference in kind of philosophy?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question, and I think it's a question of scale. And I think this goes to like the evolution of a wine drinker, and my wife Mary will tell you this, is that with Cabernet, for it to arrive on the stage, it has to have a requisite weight and power and richness, right, to kind of play on the world stage. And most people start their wine life with Bordeaux and with Cabernet, kind of pursuing this, you know, really big wine. And we had this really, really good fortune to work with Rebecca Wasserman in Burgundy, where we did our internship, and she helped us understand that wine doesn't need to be about power, right? It's not about scale, right? And when you why this that story or why this discussion I think is important is Mary, I watched Mary, she would have customers who would come in and, you know, buy $10,000 worth of Cabernets and Bordeaux and bigger wines. And now those same people are customers of our Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, and they've kind of sold off all their Cabernet after they've kind of come full circle. So I think, you know, in the wine life, you start off pursuing these big wines, and then you have your first Burgundies, and you go like, wow, how can so much flavor be concentrated in these two grapes? And then understanding that it's not about scale, it's about wines that just capture your complete attention. And like when you've had great Pinot, you just want to keep smelling it. You don't want the wine to go away, right? And it's not a huge wine, it's not a big wine, it's a complete wine. And I think as wine lovers go through their life, they go through this pursuing the big and then coming back to Burgundy, Chardonnay, and Pinot Noir, and then eventually you'll end up in Barolo, but that's for a different discussion.
Right.
But,
yeah, that's interesting.
You know, I think it's kind of the natural evolution. So, yeah, the approach, I think, is completely different. You know, you can go out as a Pinot Noir and Chardonnay winemaker and be absolutely comfortable talking about elegance, purity, persistence, you know, really complete wines. Whereas if you're a Cabernet producer, you kind of have to go out with this large footprint, you know, to make your case. And I think people get there now in a lot of different ways around the world, and it makes even Cabernets that are, I don't want to say unnatural, but not true to the varietal, if that makes sense. You know, they're picking stuff so ripe now that they're 17% alcohol and picked at 32 Brix, and you know, you don't know if you're drinking a port or if you're drinking a Cabernet or what it is.
That's what happens when you pick at the end of October.
That's what happens when you pick at the end of October.
Well, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. And, you know, we have a rule in the house that if the fruit doesn't ripen by the Lions game on Thanksgiving, we don't plant it. So that's our rule.
Which Thanksgiving, Canadian or American?
American, and coming up next week. So happy Thanksgiving to all three and four listeners out there. But,
yeah,
you know, I want to...
We're going to air this after Thanksgiving, but thanks for ruining it for me.
So do you get out here often, Luke, out to California?
I do.
All right.
I do. A couple times a year. I'm coming out in the end of January to do some in-person podcasts.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, you know, when you do, you know, come by. Maybe I probably have enough spare hockey equipment. We can go out and play a game of shinny. There's a bunch of pickup here in Santa Rosa. Get you back on skates.
Oh my God.
You see, once you're back in, you gotta get back in there. And I know I can tell that you're passionate about wine. You're passionate about hockey. So got to get you back out on the ice.
And maybe I'll get a juicy rebound.
You will get a juicy rebound. You know, there's actually some decent players, some guys that have played either D1 hockey or AHL. So that's always a problem. Always a problem. If you can just push them to the corner, you won the day. But we're super skilled guys. But
cross check them.
Well, that's what I try to do. Hit them in the kidneys. You know, you kind of learn those soft spots in front of the net. Don't let them give them any room.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
So when you're coming out in January, and then you'll come out again maybe later in the year.
Probably in the fall, do some more podcasts and stuff like that.
All right. Well, then definitely, look us up.
Good.
We'll have.
Yep.
So you're gonna
stick with me just for one more minute.
Yeah.
I'm gonna finish up here, and then we're gonna do a little bonus. All right. All right. So thanks for listening. I hope you had a great time listening, and be sure to rate it, review it, and share it. And if you like, feel free to give me 5 stars on Apple and Spotify podcasts. It has to be 5 stars. If you're thinking 4, 3, or 2, don't press that button. Don't press it. Also, I'd like to invite you to join and follow the Cork and Taylor Facebook and Instagram pages. Please can consider supporting us on the Cork and Taylor Patreon page and think global domination. I'm Canadian. Think global domination. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Cork and Taylor Wine Podcast.